He was called King of the Golden River. This was a recognition of his wealth and achievements and the source of his success, which was not quite the classical River of Gold. It was a considerable advance on his former nickname, which was Piss Harry. Harry King had made his fortune by the careful application of the old adage, "Where there's muck, there's brass." There was money to be made out of things that people threw away, especially the very human things that people threw away. The real foundations of his fortune came when he started leaving empty buckets at various hostelries around the city centre, especially those that were more than a gutter's length from the river. He charged a very modest fee to take them away when they were full. It became part of the life of every pub landlord. They'd hear a clank in the middle of the night and turn over in their sleep, content in the knowledge that one of Piss Harry's men was, in a small way, making the world a better-smelling place. They didn't wonder what happened to the full buckets, but Harry King had learned something that can be the key to great riches. There is very little, however disgusting, that isn't used somewhere in some industry. There are people out there who want large quantities of ammonia and saltpeter. If you can't sell it to the alchemists, then the farmers probably want it. If even the farmers don't want it, then there is nothing, nothing, however gross, that you can't sell to the tanners. Harry felt like the only man in a mining camp who knows what gold looks like. He started taking on whole streets at a time and branched out. In the well-to-do areas, the householders paid him to take away night soil, the by now established buckets, the horse manure, the dustbins, and even the dog muck. Dog muck? Did they have any idea just how much the tanners paid for the finest white dog muck? It was like being paid to take away squishy diamonds. Harry couldn't help it. The world fell over itself to give him money. Someone somewhere would pay him for a dead horse or 2 tons of prawns so far beyond their best-before date it couldn't be seen with a telescope. And the most wonderful part of it all was that someone had already paid him to take them away. If anything absolutely failed to find a buyer, not even from the catmeat men, not even from the tanners, not even from Mr. Dibbler himself, there were his mighty compost heaps downstream of the city, where the volcanic heat of decomposition made fertile soil. 10p a bag, bring your own bag, out of everything that was left, including, according to rumour, various shadowy businessmen who had come second in a takeover battle. Brings up your daily as a treat. He'd kept the wood pulp and rags business closer to home, though, along with the huge vats that contained the golden foundations of his fortune, because it was the only part of his business that his wife Effie would talk about. Rumour had it that she had also been behind the removal of the much-admired sign over the entrance to his yard, which said, "H. King, taking the piss since 1961. Now it read, "H. King, recycling nature's bounty." A small door within the large gates was opened by a troll. Harry was very forward-looking when it came to employing the non-human races, and had been among the first employers in the city to give a job to a troll. As far as organic substances were concerned, they had no sense of smell.
"Yes?"
"I'd like to speak to Mr. King, please."
"What about?"
"I want to buy a considerable amount of paper from him. Tell him it's Mr. De Word."
"Right."
The door slammed shut. They waited. After a few minutes, the door opened again.
"The King will see you now,"
the troll announced. And so William and Goodmountain were led into the yard of a man who, rumour said, was stockpiling used paper hankies against the day someone found a way of extracting silver from bogies. On either side of the door, huge black Rottweilers flung themselves against the bars of their day cages. Everyone knew Harry let them have the run of the yard at night. He made sure that everyone knew, and any nocturnal miscreant would have to be really good with dogs unless they wanted to end up as a few pounds of Tanner's Grade 1 white. The King of the Golden River had his office in a two-story shed overlooking the yard, from where he could survey the steaming mounds and cisterns of his empire. Even half-hidden by his big desk, Harry King was an enormous man, pink and shiny-faced, with a few strands of hair teased across his head. It was hard to imagine him not in shirt-sleeves and braces, even when he wasn't, or not smoking a huge cigar, which he'd never been seen without. Perhaps it was some kind of defence against the odours which were, in a way, his stock in trade.
"Evening, lads," he said amiably. "What can I do for you, as if I didn't know?"
"Do you remember me, Mr. King?" said William.
Harry nodded. "You're Lord de Worde's son, right? You put a piece in that letter of yourn last year when our Daphne got wed, right? My Effie were that impressed all those nobs reading about our Daphne."
"It's a rather bigger letter now, Mr. King."
"Yes, I did hear about that," said the fat man. "Some of 'em's already turning up in our collections. Useful stuff. I'm getting the lads to store it separate."
His cigar shifted from one side of his mouth to the other. Harry could not read or write, a fact which had never stopped him besting those who could. He employed hundreds of workers to sort through the garbage. It was cheap enough to employ a few more who could sort through words.
"Mr. King," William began.
"I ain't daft, lads," said Harry. "I know why you're here, but business is business. You know how it is."
"We won't have a business without paper," Goodmountain burst out.
The cigar shifted again.
"And you'd be—"
"This is Mr. Goodmountain," said William, "my printer."
"Dwarf, eh?" said Harry, looking Goodmountain up and down. "Nothing against dwarfs, me, but you ain't good sorters. Gnolls don't cost much, but the grubby little buggers eat half the rubbish. Trolls are okay. They stop with me because I pays 'em well. Golems is best. They'll sort stuff all day and all night. Worth their weight in gold, which is bloody near what they want paying these days."
The cigar began another journey back across his mouth.
"Sorry, lads, a deal's a deal. Wish I could help you. Sold right out of paper. Can't."
"You're knocking us back just like that," said Goodmountain.
Harry gave him a narrow-eyed look through the haze.
"You talking to me about knocking back? Don't know what a tosheroon is, do you?" he said.
The dwarf shrugged.
"Yes, I do," said William. "There's several meanings, but I think you're referring to a big caked ball of mud and coins, such as you might find in some crevice in an old drain where the water forms an eddy. They can be quite valuable."
"What? You've got hands on you like a girl," said Harry,
so surprised that the cigar momentarily drooped.
"How come you know that?"
"I like words, Mr. King."
"I started out as a muckraker when I were 3, said Harry, pushing his chair back. "Found me first tosheroon on day 1. Of course, one of the big lads nicked it off me right there, and you tell me about being knocked back. But I had a nose for the job even then. Then I—"
They sat and listened, William more patiently than Goodmountain. It was fascinating, anyway, if you had the right kind of mind, although he knew a lot of the story. Harry King told it at every opportunity. Young Harry King had been a mudlark with vision, combing the banks of the river and even the surface of the turbid Ankh itself for lost coins, bits of metal, useful lumps of coal, anything that had some value somewhere. By the time he was 8, he was employing other kids. Whole stretches of the river belonged to him. Other gangs kept away or were taken over. Harry wasn't a bad fighter, and he could afford to employ those who were better. And so it had gone on. The ascent of the King through horse manure sold by the bucket, guaranteed well stamped down, to rags and bones and scrap metal and household dust and the famous buckets, where the future really was golden. It was a kind of history of civilization, but seen from the bottom looking up.
"You're not a member of a guild, Mr. King," said William, during a pause for breath.
The cigar travelled from one side to the other and back quite fast, a sure sign that William had hit a nerve.
"Damn guilds," said its owner. "They said I should join the beggars. Me! I never begged for nothing, not in my whole life. The nerve, but I've seen 'em all off. I won't deal with no guild. I pay my lads well, and they stand by me."
"It's the guilds that are trying to break us, Mr. King. You know that. I know you get to hear about everything. If you can't sell us paper, we've lost."
"What'd I be if I broke a deal?" said Harry King.
"This is my tosheroon, Mr. King," said William, "and the kids who want to take it off me are big."
Harry was silent for a while, and then lumbered to his feet and crossed to the big window.
"Come and look here, lads," he said.
At one end of the yard was a big treadmill, operated by a couple of golems. It powered a creaking, endless belt which crossed most of the yard. At the other end, several trolls with broad shovels fed the belt from a heap of trash that was itself constantly refilled by the occasional cart. Lining the belt itself were golems and trolls and even the occasional human. In the flickering torchlight,
They watched the moving debris carefully. Occasionally, a hand would dart out and pitch something into a bin behind the worker.
Fish heads, bones, rags, paper. I got 27 different bins so far, including one for gold and silver, cos you'd be amazed what gets thrown away by mistake. Tinkle, tinkle, little spoon, wedding ring will follow soon. That's what I used to sing to my little girls. Stuff like your paper of news goes in bin 6, low-grade paper waste. I sells most of that to Bob Oatley up in 5 and 7 Yard.
What does he do with it? Said William, noting the low grade.
Pulps it for lavatory paper, said Harry. The wife swears by it. Personally, I cut out the middleman.
He sighed, apparently oblivious of the sudden sag in William's self-esteem.
You know, sometimes I stand here of an evening when the line is rumbling and the sunset is shining on the settling tanks, and I don't mind admitting it, a tear comes to my eye.
To tell you the truth, it comes to mind too, sir, said William.
Now then, lad, when that kid nicked my first tosheroon, I didn't go round complaining, did I? I knew I'd got an eye for it, see? I carried on, and I found plenty more. And on my 8th birthday I paid a couple of trolls to seek out the man who'd pinched my first one and slapped 7 kinds of snot out of him. Did you know that?
No, Mr. King. Harry King stared at William through the smoke. William felt that he was being turned over and examined like something found in the trash.
My youngest daughter, Hermione, she's getting married at the end of next week, said Harry. Big show, Temple of Offler, choirs and everything. I'm inviting all the top knobs, Effie insisted. They won't come, of course, not for Piss Harry.
The Times would have been there, though, said William, with coloured pictures. Except we go out of business tomorrow.
Coloured, eh? You get someone to paint 'em in, do you?
No, we've got a special way, said William, hoping against hope that Otto was serious. He wasn't just out on a limb here, he was dangerously out of the tree.
That'd be something to see, said Harry.
He took out his cigar, stared reflectively at the end, and put it back in his mouth. Through the smoke, he watched William carefully. William felt the distinct unease of a well-educated man who has to confront the fact that the illiterate man watching him could probably outthink him 3 times over. "Mr. King, we really need that paper," he said, to break the thoughtful silence.
"There's something about you, Mr. Deward," said the King. "I buy and sell clerks when I need 'em, and you don't smell like a clerk to me. You've got the air about you of a man who'd scrabble through a ton of shit to find a farthing, and I'm wondering why that is."
"Look, Mr. King, will you please sell us some paper at the old price?" said William.
"Couldn't do that, I told you. A deal's a deal. The engravers have paid me," said Harry shortly.
William opened his mouth, but Goodmountain laid a hand on his arm. The King was clearly working his way to the end of a line of thought. Harry went over to the window again and stared pensively at the yard with its steaming piles. Then,
"Oh, will you look at that?" he said, stepping back from the window in tremendous astonishment. "See that cart at the other gate down there?"
They saw the cart.
"I must have told the lads 100 times, don't leave a cart all laden up and ready to go right by an open gate like that. Someone'll nick it, I told 'em."
William wondered who'd steal anything from the King of the Golden River, a man with all those red hot compost heaps.
"That's the last quarter of the order for the Engravers Guild," said Harry to the world in general. "I'd have to repay 'em if it got affinched right out of my yard. I'll have to tell the foreman. He's getting forgetful these days."
"We shall be leaving, William," said Goodmountain, grabbing William's arm again. "Why, we haven't—"
"However can we repay you, Mr. King?" said the dwarf, dragging William towards the door. "The bridesmaids'll be wearing Odin Nil, whatever that is," said the King of the Golden River. "Oh, and if I don't get $80 from you by the end of the month, you lads'll be in deep—"
The cigar did a double length of the mouth.
"Trouble. Head downwards."
2 minutes later, the cart was creaking out of the yard under the curiously uninterested eyes of the troll foreman.
"No, it's not stealing," said Goodmountain emphatically, shaking the reins. "The King pays the bastards back their money, and we pay him the old price. So we're all happy except for the inquirer, and who cares about them?"
"I didn't like the bit about the deep pause trouble," said William. "Head downwards."
"I'm shorter than you, so I lose out either way up," said the dwarf,
After watching the cart disappear, the king yelled downstairs for one of his clerks and told him to fetch a copy of the Times from bin 6. He sat impassively, except for the oscillating cigar, while the stained and crumpled paper was read to him. After a while, his smile broadened, and he asked the clerk to read a few extracts again.
"Ah," he said, when the man had finished, "I reckon that was it. The boy's a born muckraker. Shame for him, he was born a long way from honest muck."
"Shall I do a credit note for the engravers, Mr. King?"
"Aye."
"You reckon you'll get your money back, Mr. King?"
Harry King usually didn't take this sort of thing from clerks. They were there to do the adding up, not discuss policy. On the other hand, Harry had made a fortune seeing the sparkle in the mire, and sometimes you had to recognise expertise when you saw it.
"What colour's order nil?" he said.
"Oh, one of those difficult colours, Mr. King, a sort of light blue with a hint of green."
"Could you get ink that colour?"
"I could find out. It'd be expensive."
The cigar made its traverse from one side of Harry King to the other. He was known to dote on his daughters, who he felt had suffered rather from having a father who needed to take two baths just to get dirty.
"We shall just have to keep an eye on our little writing man," he said. "Tip off the lads, will you? I wouldn't like to see our Effie disappointed."
The dwarfs were working on the press again, Saccharissa noted. It seldom stayed the same shape for more than a couple of hours. The dwarfs designed it as they went along. It looked to Saccharissa that the only tools a dwarf needed were his axe and some means of making fire. That'd eventually get him a forge, and with that he could make simple tools, and with those he could make complex tools, and with complex tools a dwarf could make more or less anything. A couple of them were rummaging around in the industrial junk that had been piled against the walls. A couple of metal mangles had been melted down for their iron already, and the rocking horses were being used to melt lead. One or two of the dwarfs had left the shed on mysterious errands too, and had returned carrying small sacks and furtive expressions. A dwarf is also very good at making use of things other people have thrown away, even if they haven't actually thrown them away yet. She was turning her attention to a report of the Knapp Hill Jolly Pals annual meeting, when a crash and some cursing in Ubervaltian, a good cursing language, made her run over to the cellar entrance.
"Are you all right, Mr. Creek? Do you want me to go and get the dustpan and brush?"
"Podrovaxi, jaltsir!" "Oh, sorry, Miss Saccharissa. There has been a minor pothole on the road to progress."
Saccharissa made her way down the ladder. Otto was at his makeshift bench. Boxes of demons hung on the wall. Some salamanders dozed in their cages. In a big dark jar, land eels slithered. But a jar next to it broken.
"I was clumsy and knocked it over," said Otto, looking embarrassed, "and now the stupid eel has gone behind the bench."
"Does it bite?"
"Oh no, they are very lazy wretches."
"What is this you've been working on, Otto?" Saccharissa said, turning to look closer at something big on the bench. He tried to dart in front of her.
"Oh, it is all very experimental."
"The way of making coloured plates?"
"Yes, but this is just a crude lash-up."
Saccharissa caught sight of a movement out of the corner of her eye. The escaped land eel, having got bored behind the bench, was making a very sluggish bid for new horizons where an eel could wriggle proud and horizontal.
"Please don't," Otto began.
"Oh, it's all right. I'm not at all squeamish."
Saccharissa's hand closed on the eel. She came to, with Otto's black handkerchief being flapped desperately in her face.
"Oh, my goodness," she said, trying to sit up.
Otto's face was a picture of such terror that Saccharissa forgot her own splitting headache for a moment.
"What's happened to you?" she said. "You look terrible."
Otto jerked back, tried to stand up and half-collapsed against the bench, clutching at his chest.
"Cheese!" he moaned. "Please get me some cheese! Or a big apple! Something to bite, please!"
"There's nothing like that down here.
Keep away from me, and do not breathe like that!" Otto wailed.
"Like what?"
"The bosom's going in and out and up and down like that! I am a vampire, a fainting young lady. Please understand the panting, the heaving of the bosoms. It calls something terrible from within."
With a lurch, he pushed himself upright and gripped the black twister ribbon from his lapel.
"But I will be strong," he screamed. "I will not let everyone down."
He stood stiffly to attention, although slightly blurred because of the vibration shaking him from head to foot, and in a trembling voice sang,
"Oh, will you come to the mission? Will you come, come, come? There's a nice cup of tea and a bun, bun, bun."
The ladder was suddenly alive with tumbling dwarfs.
"Are you all right, miss?"
said Bodney, running forward with his axe. "Has he tried anything?"
"No, no, he's—"
"The drink that's in the living vein is not the drink for me."
Sweat was running down Otto's face. He stood with one hand pressed over his heart.
"That's right, Otto," shouted Saccharissa. "Fight it, fight it." She turned to the dwarfs. "Have any of you got a piece of raw meat?"
"To life anew and temperance too, and to pure cold water we'll come."
Veins were throbbing on Otto's pale head.
"Got some fresh rat fillets upstairs?" muttered one of the dwarfs. "Cost me tuppence." "You get 'em right now, Gowdy," snapped Bodney. "This looks bad."
"Oh, we can drink brandy on gin if it's handy, and we can sup whisky on rum, but the drink we pour and we drink no more is the—"
"Tuppence is tuppence, that's all I'm saying."
"Look, he's starting to twitch," said Saccharissa.
"And he can't sing either," said Gowdy. All right, I'm going, I'm going."
Saccharissa patted Otto's clammy hand.
"You can beat it," she said urgently. "We're all here for you, aren't we, everyone? Aren't we?"
Under her baleful gaze, the dwarfs responded with a chorus of half-hearted yeses, even though Bodner's expression suggested that he wasn't certain what Otto was here for. Gowdy came back with a small package. Saccharissa snatched it out of his hand and held it out to Otto, who reared back.
"No, it's just rat," said Saccharissa. "Perfectly okay. You're allowed rat, right?"
Otto froze for a moment and then snatched up the packet. He bit into it. In the sudden silence, Saccharissa wondered if she wasn't hearing a very faint sound, like the straw at the bottom of a milkshake. After a few seconds, Otto opened his eyes and then looked sidelong at the dwarfs. He dropped the packet.
"Oh, what shame! Where can I put my face, or what must you think of me?"
Saccharissa clapped with desperate enthusiasm.
"No, no, we're all very impressed, aren't we, everyone?"
Out of Otto's sight, she waved one hand very deliberately at the dwarfs. There was another ragged chorus of agreement.
"I mean, I have been going through cold bat now for more than 3 months," muttered Otto. "It is such a disgusting thing to break down now, and—"
"Oh, raw meat's nothing," said Saccharissa. "That's allowed, isn't it?"
"Yes, but for a second there I nearly—"
"Yes, but you didn't," said Saccharissa. "That's what's important. You wanted to and didn't."
She turned to the dwarfs.
"You can all go back to what you were doing," she said. "Otto is perfectly all right now."
"Are you sure?"
Bodney began, and then nodded. He'd rather have argued with a wild vampire than Saccharissa at this moment.
"Right you are, miss."
Otto sat down, wiping his forehead as the dwarfs filed out. Saccharissa patted his hand.
"Do you want a drink?"
"Oh,
of water, Otto," said Saccharissa.
"No, no, everything is okay, I think. Oh, dear, my goodness, I am so sorry. You think you are on top of it, and then suddenly it all comes back to you. What a day."
"Otto?"
"Yes, miss?"
"What actually happened when I grabbed the eel, Otto?"
He winced.
"I think this is maybe not the time."
"Otto, I saw things. There were flames and people, a noise. Just for a moment. It was like watching a whole day go past in a second. What happened?"
"Well," Otto said reluctantly, "you know how salamanders absorb light?"
"Yes, of course."
"Well, the eels absorb dark light. Not darkness exactly, but the light within darkness. Dark light, you see, dark light, well, it has not been properly studied. It is heavier than normal light, you see, so most of it is under the sea or in the really deep caves in Überwald. But there is always a little of it, even in normal darkness. It really is very fascinating."
"It's a kind of special magic light, right? Could we just get more towards the point a bit?"
"I have heard it said that dark light is the original light from which all other types of light came."
"Otto!"
He held up a pale hand.
"I have to tell you these things. Have you heard the theory that there is no such thing as the present? Because if it is divisible, then it cannot be the present. And if it is not divisible, then it cannot have a beginning which connects to the past and an end that connects to the future. The philosopher Heiderhorn tells us that the universe is just a cold soup of time, all time mixed up together. And what we call the passage of time is merely quantum fluctuations in the fabric of space-time."
"You have very long winter evenings in Überwald, don't you?"
"You see, dark light is held to be the proof of this," Otto went on, ignoring her. It is light without time. What it illuminates, you see, is not necessarily now.
He paused, as if waiting for something.
Are you saying it takes pictures of the past? Said Saccharissa.
Or the future? Or somewhere else? Of course, in reality, there is no difference.
And all this you point at people's heads?
Otto looked worried.
I am finding strange side things. The dwarfs say that dark light has odd effects, but they are very superstitious people, so I did not take that seriously. However,
he scrabbled among the debris on his bench and picked up an iconograph.
Oh, dear. This is so complicated, said Otto. Look, the philosopher Kling says the mind has a dark side and a light side, you see, and dark light is seen by the dark eyes of the mind.
He paused again.
Yes, said Saccharissa politely.
I was waiting for the roll of thunder, said the vampire. But, alas, this is not Ubewald.
You've lost me there, said Saccharissa.
Well, you see, if I was to say something portentous like the dark eyes of the mind back home in Ubewald, there would be a sudden crash of thunder, said Otto. And if I was to point at a castle on a towering crag and say, yonder is the castle, a wolf would be bound to howl mournfully, he sighed. In the old country, the scenery is psychotropic and knows what is expected of it. Here, alas, people just look at you in a funny way.
All right, all right. It's a magical light that takes uncanny pictures, said Saccharissa.
That's a very newspaper way of putting it, said Otto politely.
He showed her the iconograph.
Look at this one. I wanted a picture of a dwarf working in the patrician study, and I got this.
The picture was a wash of blurs and swirls, and there was a vague outline of a dwarf lying down on the floor and examining something. But superimposed on this was quite a clear picture of Lord Vetinari. Two pictures of Lord Vetinari, each figure staring at the other.
Well, it's his office, and he's always in there, said Saccharissa. Does the magic light pick that up?
Maybe, said Otto. We know that what is physically there is not always what is really there. Look at this one.
He handed her another picture.
Oh, that's a good one of William, she said, in the cellar, and that's Lord de Worde standing just behind him, isn't it?
Is it? Said the vampire. I don't know the man. I do know that he was not in the cellar when I took the picture. But you only have to talk to Mr. William for any length of time to see that, in a way, his father is always looking over his shoulder.
That's creepy.
Saccharissa looked around the cellar. The stone walls were old and stained, but they certainly weren't blackened.
I just saw people, men fighting, flames and silver rain. How could it rain underground?
I do not know. That's why I study dark light.
Noises above suggested that William and Goodmountain had returned.
I wouldn't mention this to anyone else, said Saccharissa, heading for the ladder. We've got enough to deal with. That's creepy.